I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss the psychology of cults. And with us this morning, psychologist Michael Abruzzese, psychiatrist Jonathan Swartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning to you all.
Hi, Mindy.
Good morning.
All right, so I guess we should start with, how do we define cult? Who wants to take that on?
Well, I'll start. Okay. It refers to a group of people who share a common idea, very frequently follow the teachings of a charismatic leader. And then it has all different kinds of characteristics. Some cults can be quite positive in terms of human growth and productive, and others are very coercive. And generally, I think the phenomenon of cults, we think of the coercive, destructive kind of cults, where the group, where the individual is isolated from his previous connections, family, home, et cetera, and his whole life is dominated and controlled by the cult, and he's required to adopt all the ideology in spite of information to the contrary, and. There's a we-they aspect. We have the truth, the people in the cult, and you don't. Mm. The others don't. Too bad for you. So there's a real division, and it really kind of takes the individual out of their life and puts them in a very structured, or more structured life, which is what the cult satisfies. It satisfies a sense of group. It satisfies a sense of safety and belonging. And that's why it's appealing. Mm-hmm. I think we need to – I suggested this topic because at least I'm noticing, and others are too, just how tribal we've become in our politics these days. We don't want to even talk to others that don't share our views or associate with them. And we can be very closed-minded to another point of view, dismiss it right away. Learning about cults or looking at cults is an extreme form of mind control, if you will. Looking at an extreme form of some phenomenon, you can learn more about what is more sort of normal or acceptable in day-to-day life. That's actually a principle I was quite impressed with when I went to medical school. Yeah. And just how much studying disease elucidates normal functioning.
Saying medical school was a cult? Well, a disease model?
Yeah. There's aspects of it, certainly, that is cultish. We need to understand what's involved in a group think. And I think we need to be more aware of it these days because of our political turmoil that we're in.
And I think we think of cults as being religious group, but they're not necessarily religious.
No,
yeah, I mean, some are, but anybody want to add anything to that definition?
You know, Mark and I talked about this before in one of our shows with you about conspiracy theories. Mm-hmm. There was a very lot of overlap between conspiracy theories, the cognitive and emotional processes that go into people who believe or start conspiracy theories, the same thing with the cult. And there are particular definitions. There's a rubric about what is supposed to be cultish behavior. And all a cult will have to do is simply omit one of those official definitions. If they're not coercive, if they're not totally isolative, then the leader can easily say, no, we're not a cult. You know, when in reality, it's more of the totality of the felt experience. And also, I think if someone's in a cult, it partially is defined by the people who are on the outside looking in, because sometimes when you're in the middle of something, you really, really can't say mm-hmm. what's going on. It's like, you know, trying to look inside to your own heart or your own world. You really can't look other than looking into a mirror and see what your own body looks like even. So a lot of it has to be in the eye of the beholder and the experience of the beholder, and that's why it's so hard to get through to other people and try and break them free. That's why back in the 70s or 80s, you might remember we had these people who would go to the Moonies or other mm-hmm. organizations to try and kidnap the children back.
Yeah, deprogramming.
Deprogramming kind of stuff like that. Because it's very disruptive to the original cult or tribal unit, which is the family that mm-hmm. people have had for years. And people, I think, look in a very simple manner, is people trying to recreate an idealized family that they wish they had or they thought they should have based on TV or books or movies or stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Jonathan, what do you think?
Well, I would say, you know, and you've heard me say in previous shows that I think that the dissolution of the nuclear family and the transience of so much in life now is one of the really most destructive forces that exists in our society. And certainly the magnetism of a very powerful group is aided by that.
The dissolution of religion, too. Mm-hmm. Religion has become faded from the scene a lot in the Western world.
Absolutely. I also wanted to add that I think that some of the characteristics that separate we were talking about the definite, what, you know, where does a religion begin or end and a cult begin, or, you know, really how do we define a cult? I think the bullying behavior is both within the cult, but also in terms of the separation of people who are inside the cult from those who are outside the cult. Is part of it, and also a lack of respect for views that may not be entirely consistent with what whoever the leader of the cult is espousing is also a characteristic that you wouldn't. And I think that's why a cult does, by definite, have a pejorative connotation, because we like to think of that it's important to be respectful of each other, even if we disagree. We like to think that bullying is not a healthy way to behave, yeah. And yet those are both very, very central to phenomena in a cult.
Well, by that definition, then every religion that that has ever been recorded in history is cultish, because there's always people must adhere to our beliefs, mm-hmm. and if you don't adhere to our beliefs, and then people say, well, I don't want to, I'm going to start my own religion. You know, you have mm-hmm. the great schism in Christianity versus Eastern religion, and in Christianity, the split-offs between the major religion and then different kind of groups of Protestantism, and there's still more splinter groups and more splinter groups.
But I'm not sure I would agree with that, because I think that even within the Judeo-Christian tradition and even within the Islamic tradition, as I understand it, what separates subgroups from others is what we call fundamentalism versus a more liberal interpretation of whatever the scriptures are. Certainly in Judaism, questioning what is true, what is not true, is very central to the Jewish tradition. But again, even within the Jewish tradition, there are certain groups that tend to be very, very rigid, very, very cultish.
Right. We identify them as schisms or cultish, even in Christianity, splinter groups and things like that, right.
So I would say within every religion, there certainly are cults.
There's but, a more accepting and a more cultish aspect
that's
of that.
Right.
Yes, it's not monolithic in that respect, right.
So when we're talking about, you know, the less, you know, religious people who are looking for family. So that's, what is attracting someone to a cult? And especially, I guess, teens maybe escaping destructive family life. They're looking for maybe choosing the lesser of two evils.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
It's like, okay, this is, I mean, that can be said of gangs. I mean, you know, a lot of kids, they're just looking for that acceptance in someone, to take care of them or help them. And so would you say teens are very susceptible to this?
I would. Yeah. It's because we generally feel unsafe. And I think our culture is changing so much nowadays in recent years that everybody feels disrupted. There's not much solid ground that we can count on. This is not, you know, the 50s when the culture was when there was opportunity and there was opportunity for everybody and there was expectations of behaviors and morality, religion, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Jones down the street was calling your mom if you were.
There you go. Yeah. Right. Right.
Well, I think at base what we're talking about here is when people are faced with the dissolution of their own family or disaffection, I think it's always been that when people feel powerless, they have to either find, join, or even create a more powerful organization that can protect them, like Mark said.
Yeah.
And that really seems to be the hallmark of how religions or religious belief, even paganism, started, a belief in a higher being that is more powerful than yourself that can protect you.
Right.
And practically, in day-to-day, you joined groups, a guild or a clique, some kind of thing like that, even middle school, high school. Mm-hmm. You want to be with a clique that's going to protect you from being ostracized or being teased and that. So I think it's a very, very powerful anxiety reduction desire that a lot of people have to go with a more powerful person or group to help them feel safer.
Yeah, so they'll go to a Trump rally, for instance.
One of the points made in the literature, which I think has a lot of...
I personally would not feel safe at a Trump rally. I'm just
you wouldn't. Others do.
One of the points made in the literature is that people who are drawn into cults are typically people with poor self-esteem, mm-hmm. which makes complete sense. Mm. So people who have really very healthy, positive self-esteem are people who... are more likely to trust their own instincts and mm-hmm. what feels good inside. But people without very good self-esteem are looking for something, somebody to fill mm-hmm. them up, to give them a sense of purpose, an identity, and cults are very happy to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And most have these charismatic leaders,
yes.
right? So let's talk a little about who the leaders of these cults are, because they're fully aware of what they're doing, right? I mean, these skills they have of persuasion.
It would be hard not to be aware. And I'm thinking of, and there are probably some listeners out there who will like to hear this. Now, I'm just using this as an example. I'm not taking sides. Years ago, there was a guy named Tony Robbins, who's the mm-hmm. power of yourself and stuff. And people who have been, I've never been to one of his meetings, but people who have been there would identify the most of the people there, but not all, as a kind of a cultish following. And his behavior, very deliberate and manipulative to get people to believe in him as the leader. Though I'm told that in his group meetings, he will deny that. He says, no, I'm not that. He tries to like disavow that. But it's the same thing that it would be with an athletic star or a celebrity who says, no, I'm not a role model. I'm not a role model. By virtue of the fact that they've achieved some kind of celebrity or success, they become a role model for people like Jonathan referred to who are looking for something, mm-hmm. you know, trying to join on to something. That's why a lot of people have fans. That's why people play to their fan base. And if you don't like jazz music, then you're not going to really care about that. If you like rock and roll, you're not going to be a hip-hop artist mm-hmm. and vice versa. So I think there's always been that aspect of people who have the desire to make themselves a leader. And it has to be done through deliberateness. Nobody becomes a leader by accident. Mm-hmm. If you do become a leader of a following by accident, you can easily step down. Mm-hmm. And the people who continue going on, they're the ones who are doing it on purpose.
Well, they have to have a high dose of narcissism in their personality, of self-belief. And also that they need the group following to worship them. Mm-hmm. That's part of their nature. Mm-hmm. That's how they gather self-esteem, control, and they do control other people's lives in many of these destructive cults.
And their money as well.
And their money, right. Absolutely, right. Yes.
Right. Yeah. I remember, isn't there something in the news now in New York, there was a cult of branding followers or women to follow? I forget the Nexit or something, Nexum. I remember reading about.
The Vixim, is that what Dan just said? Am I in a Vixim? That's the cult you're talking
about.
Yeah,
that was it. And they had a number of people that they hired deliberately as recruiters mm-hmm. and paid people to recruit certain folks of certain celebrity networks and moneyed families deliberately to get them to get other people to join the cult to bring in more money. So it had to be a deliberative mechanism. Yeah. That didn't happen by accident.
And let's just say, you know, you mentioned earlier that sometimes when you're in this, you don't know it. You're in a cult and you may not know it. You might not see the outside, but you have to have somebody persuasive that's going to change your belief. It's like, you know, like Heaven's Gate, all right, the aliens are coming to get us. Most people will be like, what? You know, why would I join that? So there has to be some very persuasive.
But it's very easy to get someone to join that if you cut them off from their family, if you cut them off from any objective reality. If you marginalize the people who have a so-called objective reality, then it's easy to get people to believe the most absurd kind of things. But as soon as you step out of that orbit, you begin to think, what in the world was I thinking? Right. How can I possibly believe? Well, because you're isolated.
Right. And then there's a process that they call the conversion process of taking somebody in and isolating them, giving them a whole lot of attention around the clock, really. And sometimes keeping them up for hours. It's a brainwashing technique. Mm-hmm. Keeping them up for hours and more or less creating an emotional crisis so that the person then kind of surrenders to the group, identifies.
You might call it the Stockholm Syndrome, psychoanalytic stuff, identification with the aggressor.
Yep, Patty Hearst.
And, you know, it's right, exactly. And it's a surrender in service of your ego. Otherwise, you will fragment and, you know, destroy yourself, your sense of self. So a lot of different conceptions as to how that happens.
Right.
Yeah. Let's talk to Janet, who's giving us a call from Tisbury. Hi, Janet.
Hi. You know, about 6 weeks ago, I got to thinking about the president and his followers, and it occurred to me that it was very cultish. I don't know what made me think about it, but, you know, it seems to me that a lot of his followers politically are blind to his faults and his reasoning.
Yes.
And he does certainly need adulation. He right. keeps going on these trips and stuff, and he is certainly narcissistic in my view. It just occurred to me that that's what's going on with those people, mm-hmm. most of them.
Yeah. Anybody have thoughts?
What do you think about
yeah.
that?
I share the same thing. That's why I brought this up as a topic for today. I do think that's his behavior and his followers do have a lot of cultish aspects, features. I'm not saying it's a cult per se, but they do share a lot of those, especially in terms of how blind they are to information that is contrary to their mm-hmm. beliefs. Yeah. It doesn't matter.
And don't we do that sometimes? You know, you have a friend who got into some trouble, you know, and if it were somebody else, you go, well, how could they do that? And your friend, you go, well, you know, they're human. You when you like somebody and mm-hmm. you're a fan of somebody, you sometimes give them a little more leeway than you would somebody else. I mean, this might be an extreme, but...
No,
but
we have it today with Brett Kavanaugh. Mm-hmm. You know, are there going to be allowances for him given this allegation?
No, they made allowances for Clarence Thomas. Remember how Anita Hill was vilified?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
What would happen today with the B2 movement and with the history we have if she were testifying and Clarence Thomas was going up? Well, perhaps we'll find out with the Brett Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm. The Senate is undergoing a test, really, about how culturally relevant it is.
Janet, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to chime in this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of cults with psychologist Michael Abruzzese, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so as we get into this cult and we're talking about brainwashing, what's happening in the brain? This is rewiring our brain? What's happening?
Essentially, yes. Although the exact details are really not understood in neuroscience yet. But yes, there is a rewiring process. Things, when you're involved in a cult, there's a lot of repetitive teachings and a lot of repetitive movements, singing, for instance. Some of us will recall the Hare Krishnas in the airport. Mm-hmm. They're repeating all the time. So that nerve cells that fire together, wire together. And so that's one of the ways that the cultish mindset, or at least the ideologies, are wired into the brain by repetition and rituals. Mm-hmm. The bottom line is, yes, the brain is rewired. But the brain is already very vulnerable to this.
Mark, I just want to jump in to make sure that you're talking about simply verbal behavior can rewire the brain. You're not talking about biochemical. You're talking about the verbal behavior can biochemically rewire the brain, correct?
Yeah, exactly.
I just want to make that clear to people.
That's how we learn. Right.
I think it's, I do want to say it's we're still really at the beginning, and yet it really is remarkable how much is being learned about how memories are stored and how beliefs actually are created from neurotransmitters. We're just at the brink of beginning to understand this. But most of our listeners, and probably we here in the room, we know what muscle memory is, mm-hmm. and we mm-hmm. know from practicing any sport that the more you do it, the more easily it comes.
Musical instruments? Yeah.
Right, exactly. And I think what makes sense to me is that it will turn out that this is what happens in the brain with feelings, with beliefs, mm-hmm. with opinions. There's the equivalent of muscle memory that through repetition, practice makes perfect.
Right.
So whether it's chanting in the airport, I mean, that's a very simple, fairly probably simplistic example, but being told the same thing over and over again.
Yeah.
And again, that's not so different than those of us who grew up in a religious family and we get told the same thing over and over again. That again, a very common example, not quite the same as maybe what Jim Jones and Guyana, you know, would
teach
people.
The same principles. That goes on in psychotherapy, why talk therapy is helpful to some people, the same kind of principles. So it's not so much the what Mark is talking about, the organic process, which just exists. It's using that organic process either for a good or a negative or, a, you know, adaptive or maladaptive kind of stuff. So the process exists, but the brain does not take sides. If it'll think negative, it'll think positive, it'll think nothing. It doesn't take sides. It's an equal opportunity thinker. It'll do anything you program it to do, it'll do. Or if it's programmed accidentally, it'll do what it's programmed accidentally to do.
So to an extent. I wouldn't want to describe it completely like that because otherwise we'd all be somehow in cults and
well, I'm not sure that there would be. I think the only limit might be self-preservation.
You know, thinking
of our studies in hypnosis
And self-observation and morality, I think come into it, and connectedness with others. The things that cults
I think
tend
I could
to...
make a case that under extreme torture, you could give up your morality and give up because you can really twist that brain; it doesn't come back.
Absolutely.
But generally speaking, no. It takes a lot of intensive behavior to do that.
That's right.
But I interrupted you. I wanted to get back to you.
I was just getting to the point of how the brain is really set up for this kind of thing. One of the recent books that elucidated this was by Daniel Kahneman, a Nobel Prize winner, in economics and psychology. And he wrote this, wrote a very enlightening book called Thinking Fast and Slow. And basically he just described in a global sense that there are two systems in the brain. He called it System 1, System 2, kind of like Dr. Seuss.
thing 1, thing 2.
Yeah. System 1 is the automatic, quick thinking system, the one, the reflexive, the gut feeling reaction. That's how we decide based on a gut feeling. The system two is the deliberative one, the one that takes a lot more energy and actually puts the brain in a state of cognitive tension. Whereas system one, where you just respond automatically, there's no tension. And clearly, as humans, we prefer to be in a state of ease. Here's an example that everybody will can relate to. A bat and a ball cost $1.10. The bat costs a dollar more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? People will quickly say 10 cents. But you'd be wrong. 10 cents is the answer from system one. Quick and easy, put the things together. That's the answer, 10 cents. But if you do the math, you'll see that it has to be 5 cents is the cost of the ball. The bat is a dollar more.
What are you looking
it.
At me for? I'm not going to get it.
I don't understand that.
Okay, well, you're all system one. But the point is that the brain favors System one, and that's just an example of how we can make mistakes.
Right. I'm not a math whiz, but a dollar, it's $1.10. Where do you get the dollar five? Where's the 5 cents? I don't get it.
Because the bat costs a dollar more than the ball, and the total is $1.10.
Oh.
Okay. All right.
Okay. I said it. The bat and the ball cost $1.10.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
So our minds are lazy. That's the point.
A really good point. People don't really like thinking. And
right.
That's not an insult to people. People in general, we're hardwired to use our automatic thoughts.
That's right.
We don't want to really analyze. And when you stop to analyze,
you die.
First start doing that, it's really hard.
Yeah. Thinking is not survivalist.
Yeah. That's right.
Reacting is how you survive.
Yeah. Well, it's just like think of all the things on Facebook that you go, that can't be real, but people share it. It's got to be real.
Sure. It's quick thinking. We're really kind of wired for that from evolution, just like what you just pointed out, because it's survival. Yep. Or at least our brains that we have now evolved when we lived on the evolved to this state when we were in the African savannah. And it was quite clear that you had to think quickly and not analyze, or you would be somebody's lunch. Our brains will make decisions even when we lack information to do so. and it will fill in the blanks and actually to justify a decision that we make. That's a basic tendency of our brain.
We learned that at a very young – I'm sorry, go ahead, John.
I was just going to say that I know a lot of people who would prefer to make decisions without any information.
Sure.
Makes it a lot easier.
That's the point.
We learned that as a very early thinking skill or coping skill as a child. You know, a child always trying – if you don't tell a child what's going on to inform them with the real data, they're going to come up with their own reason. You know, my parents are getting divorced. Must be my fault.
That's right.
You know, not doing well at school, the teacher doesn't like me. They come up with their own
fill in the blank,
based on their own sense of their knowledge, and their knowledge base is not very high.
And the final characteristic, several others, where we focus our attention says a lot to how we decide and behave, because our attention suppresses other information and amplifies attended to information. Also, our mind uses shortcuts to decide things, to size things up. They're called heuristics. That can lead us astray too. So those kind of characteristics, I think, are quite relevant to how cults propagate.
That's taking advantage of the naturally occurring organic behavior we have. Someone taps into that.
That's right.
And they can control it.
Absolutely.
And the key, what I tell people when I'm working with them, is that the key is becoming aware of something.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So awareness is the absolute essential first step. So if I can prevent someone from becoming aware of how I'm fleecing them and taking money from them, then I'm good.
So that comes to the, you know, we were mentioning you could be in a cult and not realizing you're a cult. And also somebody in your family, because you're in a cult. And you're like, no, I'm not in a cult. So you know, that's a tough situation. Maybe you're a parent and your teen has gotten involved in a cult. You know, convincing them that they're in a cult and getting them out of the cult is a very difficult thing to do.
The first step is creating awareness in them, getting them to be aware of the fact that there are other variables involved. Very hard to do.
That's right. Yeah, but it's there. The brain does have that capacity. In spite of all the kind of programming and the adoption of the cult ideology, there's still a sense of self there that can be awakened. Yeah. But it's difficult.
So what's involved in the deprogramming then when, you know, you get somebody out of a cult and you have to deprogram? What's that process like?
The first step is to get their attention.
There are two methods. There's the old saying, the easy way or the hard way. You know, the hard way is the old deprogram, is you kidnap someone, you bring them out, and you have to, you sort of do the same kind of torture techniques, but in reverse. And, you know, get them out. And that's a horrendous process to go through. This is my turn to be greeted by the pitchforks and torture. It would be many people who are in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous does a tremendous job in helping so many millions and millions of people. But that's a more gentle kind of way of deprogramming people from the irrational beliefs they have. Psychotherapy, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, talking therapy, a more gentle way about deprogramming people, getting people to change the thoughts they have in their mind. So the number of different kinds of ways, because our brains are programmed to notice novel information. You know, we do things automatically, and when we do things automatically, it makes it more easy to spot something that's the anomaly. Something pops up, and we just notice that. Mark says we're going on the savannah, and I see the bushes rustling over there. I'm going to notice them because that's not supposed to be happening. Mm-hmm. So the brain is hardwired to automatize thinking to make it easy for us to survive, but also hardwired for us to notice anomalies because they might be threats.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the way that it can be helped. So the easy way is accessing the normally occurring behavior. The more aggressive way is like the deliberate programming and torturing kind of stuff like that.
Yeah, you do it with relationships, essentially.
You develop relationships that are positive and trusting and use that in the context.
Mm-hmm. And as you said, you reverse essentially the process that took place in the first place, which is to, in the same way that a cult isolates a person from their previous usual environment, when you're deprogramming somebody, you're isolating them from the cult, you're separating them. And in something like AA or NA, you know, people are told to throw out all their contact information for the dealers or the friends that they would hang out with. Mm-hmm. You trying again to sort of reverse the reverse engineering.
And you want to make their world larger, where a cult makes their world smaller.
That's right.
Enlarge their world.
Right, Carol writes, listening to your program about cults, one of your guests said something to the effect, this is not the 1950s when everyone felt included. Not exactly sure, but I think that was the sentiment behind his comment. Well, for one, I do not want to go back to the 1950s. I guess if you're a white male, then you might want to go back to the 1950s. I'm happy to be alive in the 21st century. And as with any decade and or century, there are positive and negative aspects that we need to adjust to.
I think that's a good point.
That's a very good point.
Yeah, and I don't think Mark was trying to exclude anyone by that. I think there are two ways of looking at a civilization and its inexorable march forward. There are always good and bad things in any time and any generation, and depending on the decade or the century that you're in, things can get better or worse for you. And there seems to be a natural ebb and flow, and sometimes that is sort of pushed. But there's always been persecution of people who are in the perceived outgroups, whether it's religious or cultural or social.
Well, just, I'm sorry, to add something. That seems, that comment from the listener seems to be related to the changes that have taken place in the role of women and the rights of women and the Me Too movement and so on. And it's very interesting to me that one of the results apparently of the 2016 elections is the immense number of women who were running for office. And I mean, you could see why maybe there would be a huge number of liberal people running for office in response to the elections of 2016. But very specifically, it's been a real outpouring of women. And it's really interesting to sort of think about that. And I think all of us here in the room, all the three men and one woman, would all agree that certainly our society is headed in the right direction with respect to that. And I'm sure that Mark was not meaning to.
I think part of the thing when thinking of, because, you know, I was born in the 50s, so is that, and it goes to your point, Jonathan, about family. We did have a little more family and people kind of looking out. Certainly a point. Yeah, I don't want to go back to the 1950s either. I'm with her there. But I mean, I think that's what you were.
There's two sides to it. There are things that appeal from the 1950s and things that we should be ashamed of.
Nostalgia. We're always all nostalgic for whatever decade we grew up in.
Right. There's some people who wish they could go back to the 1840s, or the 1770s and see what it's like. Their life was not so great back there. People.
A lot of hard work.
Right? It would be nice if your children could play outside once again as they could in the 50s. It would be nice if you didn't have to put a GPS monitor on your children when they leave the house. That was a nice aspect of the 50s.
So positive and negative, right, with everything. 866-999-4622. 26 is our number if you'd like to chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. More after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of cults with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we seem to have a fascination with cults. I'm just thinking now we've got that novel, The Girls, which is about Charles Manson's, The Girls, the podcast Heaven's Gate, and I think people, that's the group that thought the aliens were coming to take them in an alien spaceship. Netflix series Wild Wild Country, about an Indian guru and his followers in Oregon. We have Handmaiden's Tale. There's like all these very popular programs and books and podcasts. So what is it, our fascination with cults? What is that?
Well, I think there's always, I think I'll go back to the conspiracy theory. You know, people always have beliefs that are alternative beliefs, and some people really enjoy believing things that other people don't believe. It makes them think that they have some secret knowledge that someone else has. And there's a certain voyeurism that people always have to seeing what's going on in other people's lives. And that's not true for everyone, of course, but for some people there are. It goes back to being just as simple as if there's a traffic jam and you have a lot of rubberneckers looking at a car accident or why the police might have pulled something over, wondering why that car is pulled over to the side of the road. Again, that's the anomaly that we're hardwired to notice. This is unusual. Let me pay attention to what's going on over here. The difficulty with that is that sometimes people pay a little bit too much attention to it because it's an excellent distraction technique. And if I'm focused on the grassy knoll theory of JFK's assassination, I don't have to pay attention to what's going on today. You know, and if I worried about someone else's, if I get lost, and people do this all the time, get lost in a wonderful book, a good murder mystery, or a good yarn about any kind of thriller, It takes you away. You sort of put yourself in the role of those characters. We're kind of hardwired for this empathetic aspect. And the same thing is transferred to TVs and movies. You know, I identify with a certain kind of character, whether it's a good character or a negative character. We're kind of hardwired to like put ourselves in that position. Excellent distraction from dealing with the reality, which for most of us, fortunately, is pretty routine and mundane. Nothing dramatic's happening. It's good. Mm-hmm. Most people think that's boring, but it's really pretty good.
It occurs to me that the more chaotic life is and the less certainty there is about whatever we know or believe to be true, then the greater is the need, the sense of urgency to find something, somebody, some system to really latch onto, to center ourselves, to feel like we really do understand what's going on and that we can count on what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, we live in a time when the so-called facts seem to change more frequently than my socks. And it's a very, very difficult time, particularly, I think, particularly for young people. I think it's a very difficult
all
time
ages.
Also for, for people of all ages because of the speed with which things change. Right. And that speed leads to a sense of chaos, certainly, I think, for me and for an awful lot of people. Mm-hmm. So it does make sense that there would be we're compelled to search for something to hold on to.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's if there was a historian that was writing, was asking this question or trying to answer it 100 years from now, I think they would quote reasons along the lines of such a chaotic time that we're going through now, and being so destabilizing in so many ways of our institutions and our beliefs, and the fading out of religion that has sustained civilization for thousands of years, that's fading a bit, and so that the vertigo that's created in these kind of fire hose of new experiences that we're all being that's being aimed at us leads to an interest, if you will, in ordered kind of structured societies, even when they're overly structured, and we can at least see the costs of that. And it just stimulates our interest.
I think there's also the aspect when watching a TV show or reading that book that we're so involved in, there's also a sense of omnipotence. You know, I know what happened in the last scene. I kind of know what's coming with this character that I'm interested in coming forward. And that's why even some of the TV shows are written about in the daily newspapers. Oh, there's a big thing that happened on such and such, the end, final series episode. Because when there's a big change, a big surprise, a big reveal, that's surprising to us. So I think there's a sense of, as Jonathan was talking about, a sense of solace and having the omnipotence of seeing what's happening in the order and knowing what's going to happen next. Where in your own lives, of course, you don't know what's going on in that.
I have two thoughts as we're talking about this. One of those, thinking back, you know, in the 1940s when the musicals, everybody wanted to get away from war.
And
so musicals were very popular. But the other thing is this reality TV, which is so not reality. You look at that and it's inexpensive is why they do it. And, you know, people fall for it. People go, wow, this is, I mean, you know, look at the Kardashians. What? You know, what have they really done
what's
to be so
contribution?
Famous, right?
But
people watch these shows and they believe that this is some kind of reality and it's really all staged. It's not reality.
I often think when I'm talking, meeting with parents whose children are obsessed with video games, that on the one hand, it's really clear that playing video games 3, 4, 5, 6 hours or more a day, video games is incredibly unhealthy. But there's also a side of me that's thinking, I can understand why a child would want to check out because the life around them is really pretty painful and really difficult to grasp and to have any confidence about where your life is headed. I don't say that because again it is incredibly unhealthy, and yet there's a part of it that's easy to understand.
866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk about Scientology for a second. There's a lot of people who say that's a cult, and Scientologists will tell you we're not a cult. What are your thoughts on on Scientology. And it's made the news a lot lately from people who have left the church and made all these accusations.
Well, I was surprised by the fact that, from what I understand from reading about its history, that it was a campaign that the Scientology folks had against the IRS that got them to finally be considered a religion. Mm-hmm. I thought it was some other kind of process that people were identifying as a religion, but apparently it's getting a nonprofit religious status from the IRS, and so that was a big accomplishment for them. And people, they have closely guarded beliefs about their theory of creationism is and stuff, but they seem to have an organized theory like any other religion about how the world came to be and who you should believe and what you should believe, and it's very organized and systematized. It does seem to be rather isolating, but you get some very prominent members in television and movies and show business, and they don't seem very isolated. Mm-hmm. They talk to other people.
Right.
At least they seem to.
Yeah.
But then you have the case of Tom Cruise, and people report that he hasn't seen his daughter for, I don't know, ever since the divorce. So that makes me think that he's isolated from them or vice versa. So it seems to be a little bit of both in there.
Well, they're actually the celebrities are very much fed by the Scientologists to be out there and to present them as the face of Scientology, and they're the ultra valued members, so there's a whole system that supports that, yes, they don't get the kind of bullying, torture that other people do get in that group. It's a very mind controlling kind of group.
But still, I'm under the impression, maybe a caller can correct me, that there are tens of thousands of members that, you know, aren't mm-hmm. famous people. So
I think.
So, yeah. But it seems to appeal to a lot of people who we don't know who they are. They're just regular folks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there are bullying and aggressive and physically aggressive aspects to keeping people in it.
It kind of goes to your question, Jonathan. Where does religion end and a cult begin, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's an interesting question,
yeah.
Right? Because you could say that about some other religions as well.
True.
Yeah.
True.
All right, so we're talking about this negative connotation that cults have, but can cults be good? And what would be an example of a good cult?
A family. A positive, healthy family would be a good cult.
Yeah.
Again, we use the term cult, as Jonathan talked about. It seems to have a pejorative. That's what we tend to mean. But depending on the definition, the military could be a cult.
That's right.
People who've been in World War II, mm-hmm. The veterans can be a cult. Simply
AA.
Because it's AA.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's like, the people who believe in the cult of psychotherapy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. The cult of higher education. Not everybody believes that higher education is best for people.
The cult of Sigmund Freud.
That's right. So you can apply that term. Anyway, I'm sorry. So the cult of Sigmund Freud, would that be a good cult or a bad cult? I'm not sure. No, I'm just kidding about that.
Right.
But it could be used depending on your own attitude. It's in the eye of the beholder.
A good cult, public radio, right?
There you go. And we all sort of support it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I have to say an example of a good cult could be a religion. It could be organized religion.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
some aspects of organized religion are not as good or helpful as others. But mm-hmm. in general, I think that looking back through history, the organization that was the organized church, whatever it was called back then, seemed to have kept civilization going through the Middle Ages, through the
kept
medieval
education
times.
Going. Yeah.
Right, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess that was a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's an example of how it could be used well.
Yeah, we were talking about how people are looking, you know, for acceptance and belonging and community and all of these things, which kind of is, you know, we talked also about the fading out of religion, a lot of people stepping away from religion, where you would think this would be a time people might turn to that because that offers some of the things that they're looking for.
Well,
right?
let's talk about a definition of cult. Let's talk about what the definition of religion is. To many people, their politics is their religion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Their belief in their community, you know, their religion is that. Their religion in their trade or their belief system. Many people now, I think, are moving away from identifying themselves as being very religious, but they'll call themselves as being extremely spiritual.
I was going to say, yeah, spiritual.
You know, so
I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on that?
It exists, and it's a source of great comfort and can ameliorate anxiety, anxiety of existence.
Do you think the stepping back is just that people, it's like the organized kind of, you know, and I guess some of the, you know, the controversies, especially in the Catholic Church, has turned off a lot of people.
Sure, that's for sure. But I think a lot of people don't, when you when you get down to a religion, the religion for any individual is their local church, whatever church or denomination that is. And if they don't have people in it they feel that they're a part of, if there is this huge age difference, if you have a bunch of senior citizens that are going to church for 30, 40 years, you have a new family come in and they're the only young family, they're not going to feel part of the group. You know, no matter how welcoming the older people are going to be to them, they're going to look for people more their age and their mindset, because they're raising kids and the grandparents have already raised their kids. So there's also an aspect of boots on the ground. It's just not a good match for people.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking a lot about Trump has been mentioned. A lot of different cultish aspects of religion have been mentioned. I know that a lot of people now talk about the cult of capitalism or the cult of money, and the separation between people for whom the accumulation of money and wealth is really the only driving force in their decision making when it comes to the voting booth. I've heard many people say to me, and this was really not in the context of having any conversation about politics, but just that they vote Republican because Republicans are opposed to taxes. And for those people, many people, that's the bottom line. I don't want to pay any more taxes than I have to, and the Republicans are people who have me.
Mark talked about automatized thinking and shortcuts, easy to think of that, the system one kind of thing.
And this has I think this also has to do to some extent with this notion of the survival of the fittest being the people who can figure out how to accumulate money, and other people who don't pull up their socks and go to work, the hell with them. That's, this is what evolution is about. This is what Darwin is about. This is not, I do want to say this is not how I feel. so I don't want anybody to think that this is my point of view. But I think that to some extent, the polarization that exists today is in some way related to this notion about, well, should there be a safety net for people, or should people just have to figure out how to survive? I mean, after all, isn't that the difference between the United States and Russia or China, where we live in a society where the hell with everybody else?
Terrible way to think, though, isn't it?
But that's been, I think, the debate, if you will, throughout civilization is how much do you help others along when they're not when you feel they're not doing what they should. That's your idea about it, or characterization about it, or when they just can't for some reason. It's how altruistic are we, that's the debate that we're.
It's also the aspect of what we're looking at here in America. People in Europe have different conversations. People in Asia have different conversations. But even in a society like Japan, where they're always taught to revere their elders and their grandparents, great-grandparents, and now from what I've been reading, there's an epidemic of people who simply keep the spoiler alert. Some people may not want to listen to what I'm going to say next. Some of the people keep the bodies of their grandparents and their predecessors alive in a bedroom, mummifying, so they can still get money from the state because they get paid after a certain pension. So I guess I wouldn't say that's really honoring your elder, but I mean that's being taken to an extreme case. But even then, they don't know what to do with their elders, and we know how difficult it is if you're a caregiver for an elderly parent, and how stressful that is, especially if you're a single parent. Being a caregiver for your parents and being a caregiver for your children, and then you also have to work and take care of yourself, enormously stressful. And I think personally that's kind of really where our argument in our discussion should be, how we sort of help people to get along in the world. If we can teach people to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, okay, education has a role in that. If we can give them a stipend, if they really, really need a stipend, I don't think a lot of people would object to that. I think people object to the perception that, oh, that person doesn't really need my help. And how do you sort of make that decision? So those are the complicated things I think we have to look at as a society. And when we talk about cults, there's always a position in that argument that a cult has, and it's usually us versus them. And us is better than them, whatever them is. But any person who's part of a cult, they're also part of another cult. The guy who's the president of NSTAR, he's also a cell phone consumer. You know, mm-hmm. he may have mm-hmm. a bad cell phone day, right? Mm-hmm. So everyone who is part of one cult, they also have to interact with the so-called out-groups, and they don't always realize that, but they have to. They're all interdependent.
Mm-hmm. We all are.
Yeah.
We're going to leave it there. Psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Willey, thank you all for coming in and sharing your thoughts on this
thanks,
morning.
Mindy.
Appreciate
thanks.
That.
Thank you.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.